So hello again, thank you for joining us from the 12th International Conference of INSS in Tel Aviv. With us, retired General John Allen from the Brookings Institution. We're going to discuss with him about Middle East politics today. Following President Trump's decision in December, the U.S. Army is preparing for withdrawal from Syria, although there is no political solution for the ongoing conflict there, which involves not only the Syrian regime, but also the rebels, of course, and other actors that intervened in the civil war, like Russia, Iran, Turkey, the Kurds, and also ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So the first question, General, is, in your opinion, what are the expected outcomes of the American withdrawal decision on the ground of the Syrian battlefield?
Well, first, thank you very much for letting me participate in this.
You're welcome.
Very important questions, a great conference, very important conference. Look, your question should convey to the audience just how complex this is. And the one thing that we had come to believe was that the presence of the United States and the coalition in the conflict in Syria provided the potential for a level of stability that was not going to come from anywhere else. And from the period of time from roughly 2014, late 2014, early 2015, when we began to see real success of the coalition forces with their Arab and Kurdish allies in northeast Syria, we were beginning to have a lot of success in degrading the Islamic State, in clearing it from, you know, roughly the Turkish border along the Euphrates and east, and then slightly to the west in what became known euphemistically as the Manbij pocket. So a lot of ground in Syria was cleared by the coalition and the allies, the Arab allies and Kurdish allies. And it was done with about 2,000 American special operators, some other countries, but a lot of firepower. And look, in a country like Syria, where there is so much human misery and humanitarian, it really is a humanitarian catastrophe, this area in the northeast of Syria was one of the few places where we expected to be able to stabilize a population over a long period of time, to bring back a quality of life, and to have that period ultimately contribute to some form of political outcome. By our departure, after evidently just one phone call between the President of the United States and President Erdogan in Turkey, it removes much of the influence that we might have had, we being the West, not just the U.S., but the West, the influence that we might have had in the political outcome. And so in many respects, it cedes the war to the Russians and Bashar al-Assad. It potentially strengthens the hand of Iran. It creates an environment where Turkey may in fact attempt to attack some of our partners on the ground, in which case we may have to defend our partners from an old ally. And rather than to lead the coalition, the United States in fact has largely abandoned the coalition in this regard. So this is not a good time. We had hoped that over a long period of time, that enclave in northeast Syria would become part of the political solution. Now it's not clear what will happen.
So let's speak a little bit about them, about the Russians and Bashar al-Assad and his regime. We see lots of atrocities in Syria. We see lots of, as you said, misery, loss of human beings, and we simply don't see right now an end for this ongoing conflict as it is right now. Do you think they have the power and even the political will to end, the conflict and then get to some kind of solution that will satisfy at least the Syrians?
Now, you said they. Do you mean the Syrian leadership and the Russians?
And the Russians as the stakeholders.
Well, I think let's make sure we're clear on who the stakeholders are. It's Bashar al-Assad. And whatever that means in terms of his regime, the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and other elements that are supporting that that aspect of the war. I think they have a view on where they would like all of this to end, but I don't think they have a plan to get there. And you hear about the Astana process, which is a Russian-led process for peace. But it's going to be very difficult for those elements that the United States and the coalition has been supporting in northeast Syria to want to participate in that. clearly we still have the issue of Idlib and a very large population of Al-Qaeda supported Syrian population. And the one thing we know is that this war is not winnable in a military sense. There has to be a political outcome, which means the parties that are relevant in the process need to be part of that. And at this juncture, it looks very difficult to either see a comprehensive peace evolve out of either the Astana process or a UN-led process for now, because there are still large unresolved issues that seem to be being resolved by local conflict. We need to try to stop the fighting in multiple locations to begin to stabilize the population, to give them a voice in the political outcome. But I don't think we can see any kind of comprehensive plan coming out of Damascus yet, or one that coming out of the Russian process that's going to end the conflict anytime soon.
The fight against ISIS, despite the defeats it suffered in the Middle East, we see recently efforts of ISIS to extend its global reach and also the capability of ISIS to survive and renew some of its terror attacks in Syria and also in Iraq. How do you explain that? And is there anything wrong with the counter-terrorism strategy of the United States and the international coalition against ISIS?
Well, it's a couple of points are very important. That's a great question. From the beginning, when the global coalition came together to fight the Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State, we'll call it Daesh, it really existed in a single location. Large part of northwestern Iraq and northeastern Syria. Shortly after the coalition was formed, we saw the establishment of the caliphate. What happened with the establishment of the caliphate was several things. Foreign fighters came from all over the world, from well over 100 countries. That was the largest numbers of countries we'd ever seen, the largest numbers of foreign fighters we'd ever seen traveling to fight for the caliph in Iraq and Syria. But we then saw something very important. There were Salafi jihadi movements around the world that began to put their hands in the air and say, we want to be part of the caliphate. And over 100 around the world, Libya, Boko Haram, southern Yemen, in the Sinai, in Russia, the Khorasan, which is part of Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Islamic State became not just core ISIL on the ground in Syria and Iraq, it became what we called the provincial Islamic State, meaning there were provinces around the world that had run up the black flag and they considered themselves part of the Islamic State. So that's the second of maybe the three heads of a monster. The third head was it implanted itself very soundly on the internet and using encrypted telephone applications. It had the capacity to communicate globally in an encrypted manner, to do regional planning, to even move their fighters completely in the dark to locations to launch attacks that had really devastating effects. So in ways, and I had occasion to both fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the Islamic State, in ways we had not seen before in any terrorist organization, this organization used information, the Internet of Things, and encrypted communications to extend not just their influence in a restricted geographical area, to extend their influence overseas to these distant provinces, and ultimately to take up residence on the Internet, which is still a very powerful platform for the dissemination of propaganda and recruiting. We're going to be facing this for a long time.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.